So thanks for tuning in today to 96.3 FM Own Radio Charleston. I'm Whitney Powers, and I'm your host today for the series Small Talks, Big Ideas, a weekly 30 plus or minus minute radio show that is a collaborative space shared by four of our community's advocacy organizations, including Lowcountry Local First, Coastal Conservation League, Charleston Moves, and If You Were Mayor. While these organizations serve different needs in our community, they are largely aligned in their vision of the future. So Small Talks, Big Ideas is a space for each of these organizations to share their ideas, have tough but necessary conversations, and invite you as listeners into our work. For today's segment, we welcome Jonathan Sanchez, literary enthusiast, executive director of Y'all Fest, and owner of Blue Bicycle Books in Charleston, South Carolina. So hello, Jonathan, and welcome to Small Talks, Big Ideas with If You Were Mayor.
Hello, Whitney. Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, I'd like to begin with a little background on you. I met you many years ago, and there are lots of stories. You were footloose and fancy free, a white guy with very long dreadlocks, which always gave people pause. And you were teaching kids to build boats with my husband Edwin and how to row. So tell us a little bit about what brought you to Charleston and some of the things that still hold true for you today.
Well, specifically, I was brought to Charleston by a local media operation called the Post and Courier newspaper. So I came down here to write for them. And I wrote, I really came down to work as a clerk for them. I answered phones and wrote obituaries. And
Everyone should start, yes,
doing that. It's a great way to learn all the names, which Charleston is great in that sense, in that there's all these old names like Manago and Pinckney and such that are still around and resonate in different ways. And but I did that for about a year and a half, and then I quit and started the footloose and fancy free period you aforementioned, and have been kind of doing that ever since in just various and sundry ways, and a little more, you know, now I own a bookstore.
You're more
legitimate. A little more tied down.
And you did cut the dreadlocks off.
Well, since this is radio, I thought you would leave that up to mystery.
Yes. Well, I didn't want somebody to be mistaken for you, you know, who might
No, there's lots of much more handsome, cooler guys out there than me now with beautiful dreads. So
this is a little different than some of our other, our earlier shows. And today we're going to talk a little bit more about cities as places. And I recently saw this quote from Neil Gaiman. And I'm going to get you to tell us who Neil Gaiman is, because he's a prominent author that my daughter thinks is great. And many of you probably know him, but don't know him by name. But he said, a town isn't a town without a bookstore. That it may call itself a town, but unless it's got a bookstore, I know it's not fooling a soul. So
that's exactly how he sounds when he says it, too.
Yeah.
Fooling a soul.
So who then better to gauge that than the owner of the local independent bookshop, Blue Bicycle Books? So I want to make sure that the independent part is not lost, since there was a time when everybody said that the idea of a local bookstore, like the physical book itself, was probably endangered. And maybe you want to talk to that point a little bit, because you've been through this whole process, because I know you worked in bookstores,
yeah,
and you now own a bookstore. And this is, there's online. There were big stores, and just tell us about your niche.
Or sure, yeah,
where
happy
that thing
to.
Stands.
Well, it's funny, we talk about, you know, the bookstore being dead or the book being dead, and I don't know if this is an American trend or not, to just sort of jump on trends so quickly. And, you know, we're just always looking for the next new thing. And I think that's good in some sense. And I think it's important to be up on new things. But especially in a place like Charleston, I would think we could be a little bit like, well, let's just see how it's going to go. You know, because, when I bought the store in 2007, you know, we've been there since 1995. boy, that was all anyone could talk about was Amazon this and Barnes & Noble that. And we knew we had a nice place for people to shop. We knew we had a good product, and we were confident in what we were doing. So I think it's just funny how we are so quick to, you know, assume that paper is going to be gone and that we're going to be living in this dystopian future with nothing but Kindles and sort of riding around like those people on the spaceship in Wall-E, you know, talking into screens and drinking smoothies. Because, yeah, I mean, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We love our shop, and to get back to what you were saying about a town not being a town without a bookstore. I don't know if that's fair to say. I think there's all kinds of great towns out there, but I'm not going to contradict Neil Gaiman.
Well, I mean, I for one think that bookshops are kind of city landmarks. I mean, there was a time mm-hmm. when every Sunday I was on my way to Chapter 2 bookstore to pick up a New York
great
Times because that was what you did. It was sort of a Sunday ritual, and I've enjoyed visiting bookshops in other cities, not necessarily for the same reason, sometimes just because they're icons in those other places. My local bookstore has always kind of been the home turf, but there's, you know, I remember going into Square Books in Oxford, Mississippi, and Malaprops in Asheville, and Tattered Cover in Denver, and then there's, of course, City Lights in San Francisco.
Great stores,
And I'm looking forward to, at some point, to the fabled Haywood Hill Bookshop in London, which I read about recently, and, you know, these are almost seem to represent characters in their own right. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're stand-ins for their particular locales. I think of khakis and button-downs in Oxford, and tattooed and whatever in Asheville, fleece and yoga pants in Denver. is that something that you maybe there's something either you aspire to or something you notice?
Definitely, yeah.
In
I would like to have a dress
day-to-day.
Code at our store. So Oxford already has khakis and button-downs?
Well, we were on radio. I wasn't going to say anything about that.
But I thought
your shirt's not a button down, by the way.
Oh, it is right. I got the free flying collar going. I am wearing khakis, though. I'm pretty much a button down shirt, but which I wear every day.
But not
and
loafers.
If I could get everyone to wear that in my store, that would be great. No, we. I don't know. I guess we kind of have the we have our cool young staff with their. Artisanal tattoos. Would that be kind of a Charleston thing? Sort of stylish yet tattooed, sort of Southern garden and gun meets what's the blue gorilla tattoo? That's sort of our look.
Yeah, it's a skateboarder and garden and gun.
Yeah,
sort of, you know.
Skateboarding. But
whenever we get when Garden and Gun starts making signature skateboard decks, we know we've transcended all manner of of characterizations.
Those stores you mentioned, like Tattered Cover in Denver and Oxford Books, and, you know, you got your in Seattle, Elliott Bay Books. I mean, those are iconic places, and I think we're still a decade or so away from being even approaching where those places are. We've got some great things going for us. We have our, you know, we're in a very different city. Charleston is a great city, and it's very cool place. It's like a lot of people like to shop and eat, and it's very stylish. I don't think we're superficial, but you know, we have very attractive people here, and we there's just a lot of things to do, the hunting and the fishing. So and all the other, you know, millions of activities people do here. So we try and not fight that so much, just sort of go with it and kind of be another fun, cool thing to do. So we're not necessarily just going for, you know, if you're in Seattle, you've got a tremendous sort of book culture, and it rains a lot, and people just devour books and devour coffee. And we have great readers here too, of course, but we also have people that, you know, don't think of themselves as bookstore people, and we're definitely a shop for them.
So you have a lot of beach novels.
We do have some beach novels. It's not so much that like only beach novel people read beach novels. It's just that like we have to be the kind of shop that seems like an interesting place for anyone to check out.
Right.
Even if they might want to come in and buy a, you know, Cormac McCarthy, you know, try that out. Or, you know, it doesn't take much to pick up a book. And I think that's something that's really important. I was on the beach a few, you know, last summer, and I saw some guys. And they were really cool guys, but they were the kind of guys that go to the beach and they like bury their, you know, their cooler in the sand, and they get their tent set up and they're really rocking out. And I'm thinking, you know, these guys are never going to pick up a Kindle.
Right.
They're not, if they have an iPad, they're not going over to the iReader or whatever it's called, you know.
Right.
But they might pick up a real book.
Yeah.
Because everyone might do that. You never know where you're going to be, and someone might hand you something. So I think, you know, we talk about what does it mean to have a real book. Oh, I really like the real paper and all that. And, you know, it sounds sort of, I don't know, just sort of idealistic. But it's a real thing, and it's just much more convenient, and it's much more populist. Populist in the sense that it appeals to all kinds of people. It's a simple piece of technology that anyone can pick up and get into.
Well, there is a certain, there's this sort of dichotomy between technology and all the things that technology has given us, mm-hmm. and the sort of authenticity of you know, local food and being in a real place and doing things that are sort of have this kind of touch, you know, this sort of flavor and texture of something real. And I guess the book kind of sits in that one or the other for some people. I mean, I think you're right. I think, you know, a lot of people, the idea of just picking up a book and basically, you know, being good with it is a good way to go. I mean, somebody was talking about being pregnant and going on, you know, having to be in bed rest or something for a few weeks. And they were looking for recommendations for reading. And I said, oh, get an old copy of, like, David Copperfield, cut it into 6 pieces, and then you read it a week at a time. And, you know, you just don't have to. Maybe that's not the most religious way of thinking about books, but or sacrilege. But I thought that, you know, that kind of could take you back. But
this is someone who's been reading Anna Karenina for 4 years now, me. And I am on my second copy. The first copy was a beautiful classic sort of used bookstore find that I don't know how long I'd had. And I trucked it around from house to house and finally decided I was going to read it. And it, you know, looked great on the shelf. It was probably from the early 70s or 60s, just a nice little mass market paperback, obviously very thick. Yeah, and it just crumpled, you know, after a year, because that's how slow it's taking me to read this thing. people think that we are so, you know, there's just a lot of presumptions, I guess, that people think when you own a bookstore, that we read all the time, or that we look down on people who don't, or that we, you know, revere books to an extent that, like, you know, I mean, we donate books all the time, and we have to, you know, and occasionally they fall apart and we don't save them. You know, it's right. Okay. We save lots and lots of books because they're fun to save, and they're fun emblems of things. We love something we've gotten into on our Instagram, this is a good chance to plug the Instagram. It's Blue Bike Books or Blue Bike. I don't really do it. I'm obviously not savvy enough.
But you can probably find
it. Call it up on my phone. We'd love to put on book plates. That's kind of our Instagram-y thing. We find these beautiful little book plates that people have had, you know, from hundreds of years ago, and really interesting little the stickers they put in the in papers of the book to identify it as theirs.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Well, I'm going to look that up. Anyway, for sure. So, I guess just on a practical matter and sort of in light of its place in the city, you're like a lot of local businesses here in Charleston. I'm sure you feel the pressures of rents and the sort of changing neighborhoods and the demographics and those kinds of things. And you've recently done some renovations there.
Yes.
I guess it's been a year maybe or a little bit more. And I'm hope that means that you're here for a while. Your mm-hmm. location there kind of builds on the synergy of Marion Square, but there are a number of hotels coming up that are sort of surrounding you.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that kind of complicates the local flavor. What do you think about that? I mean, is it...
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, there's been a lot of development and some buildings going for a lot of money, which sooner or later are going to be demanding a lot of rent, and that rent has to get paid somehow. You know, for me, it's just I'm really into where the rubber meets the road. You know, I mean, I deal with writers and I deal with customers and I deal with New York publishers and their publicists all the time. But I'm the one that actually, you know, or my staff are the ones that actually take the book and hand it to you and you hand us the money. and at the end, that's the sort of the capillaries of the whole system. You know, that's when people are actually, that's what actually pays the rent. We've got a good business, and I think we've been doing a good job paying that rent, and we pay good rent, and we have great landlords. And we also bring in a lot of, you know, between, you know, we'll probably talk about the book festival and later, but between the book festival and other events that we do, I think, like, we're a good presence on King Street. I'm not really willing to, you know, to you've talked a lot about how awesome it is to have a bookstore in town, and we're happy to be that store. I don't, you know, I'm not personally the one to overstate our importance, but I do think that we offer a little more than, you know, maybe a great dress shop does. And there's some great dress shops and clothing shops near us, but because, you know, we are bringing in folks of all sorts to our events and, you know, a little bit of a landmark. But, yeah, you know, so far so good. That's really all I can say. We got to take it 1 year at a time. We are on pretty short-term leases, so we don't own our building. But we're very happy to do what we do, and we're not just there because of but, you know, we are a real business.
Right.
Let's put it that way.
Well, it's and that's pretty evident, actually, in the way that you operate. I mean, you know, not every book is not everybody can bring their books to you and every book kind of be, you know, be bought and that sort of thing. So it's
not a thrift shop.
Yeah, you're not a thrift shop.
I love thrift shops, but they're different.
So, and the books aren't a quarter for the most part.
Books are no longer a quarter. They're so, still pretty darn cheap, in my opinion.
Well, I'd like to just consider a moment the concept of reading and how important that is in a city, in ways that being digitally well-versed really can't do. I mean, I think it's very important that we have a newspaper that has won the Pulitzer Prize recently, and I think there were another couple of things that came through the pipeline in the last few days, which escaped me for the moment. But and I think that suggests that, in fact, there are people here that kind of care about information and about putting information out in a way that's valuable, and that there are some people out there that, in fact, read newspapers. Now, the business of newspapers, that's something that's being reinvented as we speak. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping to have an interview actually on this show with Mitch Pugh from the Post and Courier later this summer.
Can you tell him my idea? He needs to get more newspapers in the hands of more people.
Oh, there's that.
Because, I mean, I think that if he took, like, you know, 1,000 people who go to, like, Pecha Kucha or Movers and Shakers, you know, people who under 40,
right.
Let's face it, and just sent them the paper.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty cool.
Because I think I know he's really good on doing things online, and I used to work at the newspaper, but I read it. It's a lot easier to read in print. And
it is easier to read in print, I can assure you.
Even in Hannah Raskin's food section should be delivered to every restaurant. I think that, you know, don't worry so much about the subscriber model for certain people.
Ooh.
That's my thing.
Well,
but yeah. Get it out there.
I think that's a great idea. And it is now on the air. So
yeah.
So maybe there will be somebody who listens to
this.
They'll send me the bill. So I just wanted to mention a couple of things that I've become aware of through If You Were Mayor. There's a group in Harlem, for instance, and they're called Barbershop Books.
Okay.
And I don't know whether you've ever heard of them, but they set up little reading centers in barbershops that are in mostly, for the most part, black-owned bookshops and barbershops, and they're for the kids waiting to get their hair cut. Now, I remember going with my brother. You know, he'd go to the barbershop, and there were always comic books there.
Oh.
And you may remember. I mean, that may have been the case. Of course, you had those dreadlocks, so you might not have even.
That's true. Yeah,
that was kind of a you didn't have those so early.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is the barbershop or that sort of culture is a very big deal, and has been here. In fact, the fellow who's the national president of the NAACP, his family owned barbershops here in Charleston.
Oh, really?
He's a really cool guy. Hmm. His last name is Brooks. I can't remember his first name. But anyway, a cool guy. And there was a movie called Barbershop and that kind of thing. But anyway, back to the point, it was this apparently has had a lot of success in terms of getting books, and they're comic books and those kinds of things. And the parent who comes in with the kid is kind of compelled to help the kid read and stuff. And so it's apparently been a pretty successful model, and I don't know how widespread it is, but it's suggestive of ways of doing things differently, right? Mm. I mean, that's kind of one of the things we talk about, even in terms of the Post and Courier, as you mentioned. And And I had a friend who told me a story about having their kids in a public school in Oxford, Mississippi, no less. But they had a period of time set aside during the day, and it may have only been like 20 minutes or something. But everyone in the school had to read a book, from the janitor to the principal to the cafeteria workers. Everybody in the school had to sit down and read a book, wherever they were. And interestingly enough, even if you visited the school during that time, mm-hmm. you had to sit down and read a book. That you couldn't, there was no break.
That
was sort of a sacred sacred cow. Every day, every school day. And it was a pretty, and it made, it signified something important in that school mm-hmm. And really kind of changed, I think, a cultural, in the school itself, it sort of set up a different dynamic than one, you had to be quiet and, you know, this things that were, and adults and children alike were sort of held to the same model. And that was always kind of interesting. And the libraries have had summer programs forever and you have the summer writing camp. What are some other efforts that you could imagine or that you know are going on to mm-hmm. basically kind of build the readers in Charleston or might be happening here?
The number one I know of is Reading Partners, which is a program that teaches, brings in volunteers, and they have works with at-risk kids in schools, about 15 schools. I was on the board, and I'm still an advisor, I guess you could say, and donor. And I think they crushed it recently on Low Country Giving Day, which I was really happy to see. Did great in terms of their donations. But Reading Partners brings in, it's not just the idea of just a volunteer going in and reading with a kid, or like, you know, it's very focused. It's very, kid has sort of a curriculum, and it's monitored, and they, you know, it works. That's most important thing.
That's cool.
Yeah. I think in a community like Charleston, I hate to say it, but, you know, we're going back to it. I don't think we've ever really gotten over the concept that enslaved people were forbidden from reading. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we still have a segment of the population that just does not embrace book culture enough and doesn't have access to books, isn't taught to read. And I just think it's a, you know, I'm not even going to try and draw a historical connection. I'm saying just having that piece of history in South Carolina, I think, means that it's that much more important. It's that much more important. And I just, honestly, there's a lot of great organizations out there, but Reading Partners is my number one, because obviously I own a bookstore. Reading is important, but I know how effective they are, and that's just that important to me.
That's great. I really appreciate that, because that's what I was pulling for. You know, that's what I was looking for.
It used to be called Book Buddies.
Oh, right.
And then they kind of partnered with a national organization. It's a little wonky. I mean, they're not, you know, it's not the sexiest thing. Like, it's very focused, but it really works. And I highly encourage people to volunteer also.
Sweet. Sweet.
Yeah.
So on that kind of segue, I would like to sort of open up the discussion about Y'all Fest, because the Young Adult Book Festival, which you...
No idea what you're talking about.
I know that this is... It's something that builds on your bookstore's relevance in what I think is an interesting way. I think it's probably larger than you imagined it was going to be. Why don't you give us a little? First of all, maybe tell us what it is.
What is Y'all Fest?
Kind of where, what's been going on with it, and where does it seem to be heading?
Well, we are a 2-day celebration of young adult books that started 5 years ago. We're in our sixth year now, coming up November 11th and 12th. We're the largest young adult book festival in the world. If not us, then our sister festival in Santa Monica, Y'all West, which is now, and it's just finished up its second year. But we are our own organization here in Charleston, Y'all Fest Charleston. It's a nonprofit that I started and run, along with some young adult writers. I don't know if you've happened to notice just a few movies out there, like Hunger Games, Twilight, Divergent, Beautiful Creatures, Harry Potter, et cetera, et cetera, Maze Runner, Fifth Wave. You know, young adult literature is very hot right now, and it's not really didn't really exist when we were coming up. I mean, Judy Blume was there. Right. We had what we call middle grade, which are more your chapter books, and some of those could be rather rich and complex, like The Hobbit and Narnia. But the idea of really writing for teens, fantasy for teens, mystery, contemporary, is relatively new, and it really took off, I think, with Twilight.
But Harry Potter. I mean,
Harry Potter. Yes, too. Obviously, I mean, Harry Potter is like the gospel of Y'all Fest. But I think half the kids could recite the entire first chapter of the first book.
Wow!
But it's a great festival. It's a lot of fun. My daughter is in second grade and is really getting into it, but we have kids, you know, from fifth grade and up. Honestly, our target demographic is probably a 23-year-old young woman from somewhere in a small town in Tennessee. and we have thousands of those who come to Charleston, and this is their weekend. They wait in line for hours to meet their favorite authors. They go to the panels. They go to all the special fun giveaways that our sponsors do. They have a great time.
That is so cool. So it's gone from a few hundred people to now we're...
It was big the first year, to be honest. We kind of, you know, I'm the kind of guy, I don't really like new ideas unless I know I can really run with them. And we didn't even blink the first year. I never really worried about people showing up. And it was good that year. I mean, because it's not something I'm pushing on people. It's something I've kind of hitched my wagon to and just held on for dear life. The fun thing about our festival is it's right in the city. It's right around the bookstore. We're very lucky to have the American Theater, Charleston Music Hall, now the Charleston Museum. There's just all these great venues within two blocks of me. All the kids are out in the street and they're shopping, you know, at the macaroon shop and getting pastries and going to all the little cafes. And it's a very urban experience.
That not very many of these people.
No,
have
yeah,
otherwise.
This is not a demographic necessarily might come to Charleston. Well, God knows we have people from Mexico City and Europe and South America that come too. So
I remember the year where somebody showed up from Chicago and y'all were going, "Oh my gosh, this is great!"
Yeah. Now when someone says from Chicago, I'm like, "Great, there's 20 of you here." we're very, very grateful for all the people who come, and it's expensive to come to Charleston. The fans are the ones that have made this take off, and it's mostly through word of mouth. It's not like I am some marketing genius.
But you do get the authors to visit some of the schools locally. I mean, this is something where you've kind of
we have an amazing schools coordinator named Susan Durand, who works completely pro bono and has built up a fantastic school visit program with 20 to 30 schools. Last year, she was busing in kids through a special new program, and they were coming in, and they got to go to panels and got lunch and got to pick out a free book. For up to me, we would just have even more and more of that. When we talk about making Charleston a reading city, when you really think about books, schools, where it comes up, and kids, young adult, I mean, that's where you can really, really push books and really encourage people to read more.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, as far as storytelling goes, the nature of places all over the world have benefited from their depiction. This just is a little bit of a shift. It kind of builds on this whole reading thing, but it sort of goes back to kind of appreciating your place a bit. And mentioned earlier about how bookstores can be characters in their cities, but places all over the world have benefited from being characters in the literature where they're represented. Mm-hmm. You know, Mississippi in the mind of William Faulkner, Chicago in the work of Saul Bellow, Raymond Chandler is Los Angeles.
I know.
And then there are things like iconographically the Algonquin Round Table in New York, apart from sort of the Greenwich Village and the Beatniks and that sort of thing. These authors give us kind of a texture of the settings. And it's not necessarily a description, I wouldn't say, but the kind of, it's not this verbal photograph, but there seems to be something more. And Pat Conroy and Josephine Humphreys certainly come to mind. And I know both of them have been active, have participated in events that you've done at the store.
Many times,
And I personally have this vivid memory of reading a Jo Humphrey passage that, and she referred to the taste of the marble steps of the home where she grew up on Church Street. And it just seems like reading actually allows us to take a journey to places. And I don't know if that's kind of your cup of tea, but is that something that you would mind sort of elaborating on a little bit?
Well, I mean, one thing we sell a lot of in the bookstore is Charleston books, and there's just always more and more and more books about Charleston, novels set here, coffee table history. I mean, it's just...
I'm waiting on the dystopian Charleston book.
Well, I do have a very favorite new book coming out that I really want to tout and I think you'll love, called My Best Friend's Exorcism, which is written by Grady Hendrix, who Josephine Humphreys knew as a kid. He's the same age as her boys. And he lives in New York now, but grew up here. And it's set at, we'll just say, a private school west of the Ashley called Albemarle Academy, fictitious. But Grady grew up here and went to Porter Gaud and is really into horror. And in fact, has a really fun book called Horror Store. Store is spelled STOR with umlauts over the O. And it's a horror novel set in an IKEA. and this is a book that's about...
Sounds like he needs to come to Y'all Fest.
I've invited him, yes. This is an 80s teen friend, sort of, you know, I guess you could say like a mean girl set in the 80s, except that one of the girls is possessed. And it slowly builds, and it's just wonderful. It's a great Charleston book. He actually has some great descriptions of your South Abroad single houses and just sort of the weather and the general feel, but it's not over the top. Anyone could appreciate it. And then the horror stuff comes on so subtly, and it becomes this tension between, is this girl crazy? Is she just going through, you know, puberty? Why is she turning on her friends? And it's a great friendship story. I literally cried reading it, and then it literally has a crazy exorcism scene. And I'm just going to go ahead and say this because it was a fun surprise for me. But the exorcist is one of those guys that used to visit schools as like in the 80s and 90s who were really into, they were super beefcakey and they were, Bible beaters. Literally they're Christian weightlifters.
Right.
Who would do amazing stunts for you thanks to Jesus basically. And so that, and it's, That he ties that whole thing into the book. I can't say enough good things about it. So if you're going to read any Charleston book right now, it's My Best Friend's Exorcism. It comes out May 16th. So,
yeah. Sweet, which is pretty close to our airtime, I think.
Yeah.
And in a way, you've kind of told us how it's different from digital experiences in your head. Mm-hmm. But maybe you want to give us one more plug on the sort of written word versus the digital kind of thing in terms of imagination or whatever suits you. I'm really picking on you here.
I don't care. I think people should really explore what it means to them. I don't think people need to be told how to read or how not to read. If you really like looking at your phone at night, and I do that, my wife does it a lot too, but there's something different about me scroll. I can even be reading The New Yorker on my phone versus reading the tawdry New York Magazine.
Which I love.
Which I love too. But it's not, you know, or say Anna Karenina. Anyway, in other words, reading off a piece of paper versus reading off your iPad at night, I think it helps. It affects you. It makes you, it's different. It's easier to pick up that bright screen. It's something about just pushing the button. You just kind of by habit. I think you sleep better sometimes after you read off paper. I do. If I'm trying to go to sleep, something about just that.
Especially Anna Karenina.
It's getting good. I think things are crumbling for Anna and Vronsky. Don't tell me what happens. I want to see the movie before Keira Knightley dies. But no, it goes back to what you're saying, that amazing thing that school does with everyone in the school reading from real paper. That's an interesting, it's almost like something you would do at a religious school 50 years ago when there was forced prayer. We, you know, can't even talk about that now, but it is a piece of forced meditation that helps everyone. I think that's it is essentially a religious act to force everyone to do something quietly for every 20 minutes.
Right.
Don't tell them I said that. I'm sure someone will figure out a way to ban it. But
Well, I'm going to swing back to the bookstore in the city for a moment. Okay. And there are businesses that compare, I guess, a coffee shop, you know, sometimes that caters to those. And there's just a kind of people that gravitate to bookshops and coffee shops for a variety of reasons that speak to a kind of community. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily, oh, the person who lives next door, but it's a different kind of community. It's in, does that make sense?
I mean, it's a great community. It's weird. I wish we could film a reality show there, except I wouldn't want to have to sign the waivers and have the cameras. But I mean, the amount of craziness that we see and passion and people are constantly writing books and bringing them in. And, you know, honestly, we can't take many of them because we have to be selective and we don't have space for them. But
right.
That in itself, I mean, every day someone has poured their heart into something and had it printed with CreateSpace or, you know, all these various new ways people publish books now. And then we have our regulars and we have all the visitors that come to Charleston, and it's a fascinating, fun place to be every day.
Yeah, I mean, I was in there the other day, and I was talking to Sarah, who I guess was working that day, about
Miss Sarah Peck, our store manager and buyer.
And I was talking about this book that the author David Shields, who is a USC professor, has written a book called Southern Provisions about. And I heard him interviewed on Walter Edgar's Journal.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, different radio station, but still kind of. And but he was talking about where the seeds came from and all this kind of stuff. And I found it very interesting, and we were chatting it up. And all of a sudden, this couple was standing there going, David Shields, we know him. We've eaten at his house. And he's told us all these stories. I mean, it's very interesting how inevitably these kind of strange connections. So
you typically don't have conversations with people at Banana Republic for some reason.
That's right.
You might ask if, you know, do these pants make me look fat, but you know, that's only if you're sort of outgoing, but some bookstores do spark conversations.
That's true. Yeah. That is true. And it's good. And it's not just 140 characters generally. It's sort of, it often goes beyond that. So I have one more question because this is my general question du jour.
Okay.
If you were mayor, what would you do?
Well, I thought about this. I'll give you three quick answers. The first two are more basic. First of all, there's a lot of hotel construction. There's a lot of controversy as to how many more hotels we should have, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not really going to weigh into that, but I do think that in construction in downtown, there's now become a big issue of sidewalks being blocked off. And I think we need to make it clear when, if you're going to build, you have to keep the rights of way. You can't put your paving stones in the parking spaces. You can't put your trucks in the parking spaces. You need to provide sidewalks. We have a big construction project right near my bookstore, which they've done a pretty good job of doing that, I will say, but still is always
they've had
open.
Some creep, what I would call mission creep for sure.
Yeah, they all do. Number two, the bike lane over West Ashley. It's a civil rights issue. We have to be able to provide, for that kid who's biking downtown to sell palmetto roses. He needs to have a safe way to do that. And number three, I would love to find a way for the mayor to do even more in education. I just think that cities that seem to have mayors that run their school districts seem to do a little better. I know that's a huge political issue, but... You asked.
I did. Well, I just want to thank you so much, Jonathan, for coming in and talking to me and to our audience. I'm sure we can count on Blue Bicycle Books to continue to surprise us and give a kind of anchor to what seems to be an ever-changing landscape in the city. And that wraps up this segment of Small Talks, Big Ideas with If You Were Mayor. And again, we invite you to go online to our Facebook page. You can submit questions, feedback, and ideas for this segment. We'll post a link to the full segment if you happen to miss it when it's broadcast. If you're checking out our Facebook page, we'll give you those broadcast days. Generally, every Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock and on Friday afternoons at 2. We'll be on, and next week you can tune in to Small Talks, Big Ideas for your chance to hear from Low Country Local First about something homegrown. And thank you again for tuning in to 96.3 FM Ohm Radio Charleston and supporting your local nonprofit radio station. If you were mayor, we'll be back in about a month for another deep dive into the Charleston region. Thank you very much. And thank you, Corbin Miles, our producer.
Now I've heard there was a secret chord that David played, and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah. And even